This message is brought to you by DoNotAge.org, the longevity research organisation that's on a mission to extend health span for as many people as possible via products that actually work. Start your journey today at DoNotAge.org and use code LLAMA for a 10% discount. That's LLAMA.
Optimism can add you from 4 to 10 years of life. And then a happy romantic relationship. This can lower your mortality risk by about 49%.
Hello again, a very warm welcome to the Live Long and Master Aging podcast. I'm Peter Bowes. This is where we explore the science and stories behind human longevity. Now, whenever we talk about aging well, what we need to do to achieve a good long health span, optimizing the number of years when we enjoy the best of physical and mental health, I always think about the lifestyle traits or pillars of good health like diet, exercise, and an element of spirituality, mindfulness, strong social connections, a Zen element to our daily lives to complement the more scientifically validated elements like diet and exercise. But is that fair? Is there a scientific basis for embracing optimism, kindness, socialization as we pursue a long life? Well, with me for this episode is Marta Zaraska, a science journalist and author of the new book, Growing Young, How Friendship, Optimism and Kindness Can Help You Live to 100. Marta, welcome to the Live Long and Master Aging podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
It's very good to talk to you. In France at the moment, I'm in Los Angeles. We're necessarily talking remotely, and it's difficult to have a conversation with anyone at the moment without starting with, how are you doing? You're healthy, you're holding up during this current crisis that we're all facing.
I mean, thankfully, yes, the crisis here has very much been, and is very much under control. So things feel quite optimistic, and I think people are starting to feel alive again, especially that we've been under a very, very strict lockdown here for 56 days. So that was certainly very hard on people.
Is there a sense that things are getting better in the long term? I know here in California, there's a lot of talk at the moment about a potential second wave of the virus. We're already seeing new spikes of infections around the United States. What's the atmosphere like there?
I mean, we don't have a second wave, thank goodness, but we are definitely, people here are fearing it in the fall. So this is when people start being indoors, and generally when the virus season starts again, and that's when things can get worse again.
The very fact that we're going through this health pandemic at the moment, a viral pandemic, does focus the mind on our own well-being and generally how well we are able to cope with a sudden onslaught of a very vicious virus like this. And just reading your book, which we'll delve into in some detail, it certainly highlights the importance of just being healthy and vital, doesn't it?
I mean, certainly we've been all thinking, I guess most of people at least, a lot about how healthy we are. And especially, you keep hearing about all these underlying conditions that make the virus worse, and everybody has been taking in account, do I have any? And yes, how many? How bad are they? So certainly we've been thinking about those in those terms, I think, much more than usual.
Now, just before we talk about your book, let's just get a little potted history of your career. You are Canadian Polish, as I understand. So you were born in Canada?
Oh, no. I was born and raised in Poland. You can probably hear that. And
that was my confusion.
I've only lived for a short while in Canada, actually only 4 years. I've lived in 6 countries around the world, and I've been in France for 12 years now.
And you've been a journalist for most of your career?
24 years now, yes. So quite a long time.
And what especially interests you about this subject area? Was there one thing that piqued your interest early in your life?
Definitely becoming a mother, since I started thinking much more about health and longevity, and especially, health of my daughter. And I realized that if I were to be given only one wish, catch some kind of a golden fish or something like that, then my wish would be to make sure that she would live long and healthy. Of course, the first, when I started first trying to assure that she would be living healthy and long, my original attempt was quite classic. So I was fixating on nutrition and on exercise, making sure she was eating, you know, the best diet possible. So we lived in the US early in her life, and I was a frequent visitor to Whole Foods, where I was spending a lot of time and a lot of money. So it was a quite classic approach. But then in my career as a science journalist, I was coming across more and more research showing that my approach might not have been the best. So I started investigating. It really spiked my curiosity. The studies I started seeing on how the soft drivers of health and longevity are important. So I ended up reading over 600 research papers and talking to dozens of scientists. And in the end, I did discover that things like friendship, kindness, or optimism are actually more important to our health than diet and exercise, especially diets in the terms of kind of obsessive chasing of fad diets and supplements and miracle foods and these kind of things.
You've titled the book, as I mentioned, Growing Young, How Friendship, Optimism, and Kindness Can Help You Live to 100. What does growing young as a phrase? We're very used to growing old, but what does growing young mean to you?
I mean, it certainly does not mean growing young in the kind of Botox way of thinking, so that we are going to somehow become all 20 years old in looks and smoothen our wrinkles. It means basically growing younger health-wise, so just basically staying healthy for as long as possible. But it's more important even the growing part in terms of psychological growing, so growing as a person, and that's becoming a better person, more mentally healthy and also more socially engaged, actually helps you stay young. So this is the part that's the kind of growing mostly refers to.
And another phrase that we hear a lot, which I particularly dislike, is anti, as you would say in the United States, anti-aging, a sense that you can in some way reverse that aging process. How do you feel about that expression?
I don't like it very much either. I generally believe that we should embrace aging, and there is nothing wrong with growing older. And I'm not that young myself either anymore. Not very old either, but, you know, midway, as you can say. And I definitely think that we should embrace it. But on the other hand, we should also try to stay healthy and enjoy the, you know, the later decades of our lives. Because if you are unhealthy, then you really cannot enjoy life. And the interesting thing is that the longer people tend to live, the longer they also tend to stay healthy. This is something that surprises a lot of people. And I tend to hear often people telling me that they actually do not want to live to be 100, which I think is a very common misconception, because they think that if they live to be 100, they will end up being sick for 20 years of their lives. And this actually usually does not happen. People who are sickish and stay unhealthy, they also don't live long. So basically, the longer you keep good health, because you take care of it, of course, it's not just up to us. There is also just luck and genetics and things like that. But if we keep our good health, then also we tend to live longer. So those stories you hear about somebody who is 100 years old and starts running marathons, it shouldn't be that surprising, because if that person made it to be 100, they've probably also kept their good health.
It is also, though, a reality that people are being kept alive for longer. And people often refer to an aging population and say it is thanks to the science and the medicine and the interventions at a very late stage in life. The problem, which I'm sure that you and I agree on, is that final 5 or 10 or 20 years of being kept alive isn't the way in which we want to go.
I mean, that's certainly the case, but definitely, you know, if we take care of our health through diet, exercise, and through those soft drivers of longevity, then we have a bigger chance of avoiding just being kept alive.
Now, when I introduced you, I referred to the fact that common misunderstanding is that our diet and our exercise is in some way scientifically validated because we're bombarded every day in the newspapers, on the internet, with the latest study about diet or exercise. I think what is less commonly understood is the science behind spirituality, behind friendship, behind socialization, as I describe it, the sort of the Zen side of our lives, which is equally, and maybe some would say more important than other scientifically proven interventions that are to do with diet or exercise. And that is really the main thrust of your book, isn't it? And we'll continue this conversation in just a moment.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we're the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
Yes, as you know, we just concentrate far too much on diet and exercise, which are important. I never say in my book that diet and exercise aren't important, because they are. But a good diet and a good exercise routine are actually very, very simple. You know, you've mentioned the media before yourself and the fact that we keep hearing about study this, study that. And the thing is that, unfortunately, it's the fault of us science journalists and having to sell our stories and make them fresh and exciting, whereas the science behind nutrition and exercise is quite boring. In fact, you know, you just eat more vegetables, don't eat too much junk food, don't overeat sugar, and do some exercise, be active, but that's it. You know, nobody ever in any government I have ever seen saying you must eat ancient grains, you have to drink kale juice, you have to, you know, you have to go paleo or keto or whatever, you know. No, it's very simple, but it doesn't sell stories. So that's why we keep seeing all this kind of media reports of some newfound fad diet, because it sells newspapers. And so the same thing goes for friendship and optimism, that we don't see it because nobody's selling you or anything. There are no products here. So there is no there are no ads, there is no marketing, there are no PR people trying to make stories. There is no money to be made on telling people to spend more time with your friends. That's why it also doesn't grab attention and doesn't grab the headlines.
But you looked into this in quite an intense way. You traveled the world, you talked to a lot of people, and really did adopt a scientific approach to evaluating those lifestyle traits, which could be as simple as having a meal with friends. It could be socialization, or, as I say, the Zen side of our lives that can perhaps involve just breathing and taking a moment. But you approach this scientifically, and it comes across from your book very quickly that you surprised yourself in terms of what you discovered.
I mean, exactly the extent to which the research has already been done and how many scientific labs have been working for many, many years on that and discovering extremely physiological, biological effects here. You know, you can see the effects of kindness, for example, in the blood on the level of leukocytes. You know, how they just basically look different in people who do acts of kindness. You can see differences on the level of gene expression or brain activation. So these are very, very physiological effects here we are talking about. And this was definitely surprising to me, because if somebody told me about a book like this, let's say 10 years ago, I would have thought it's some kind of new agey stuff and, you know, just anecdotal evidence. And there is, but the truth is that there are hundreds, thousands of research papers showing that it's very much physiological, because basically we've evolved this way. You know, we are social apes.
And so what's happening, perhaps in a little more detail, when we're socializing, surrounding ourselves with whether it be family or friends or a lifetime partner, what is happening? What's happening in the brain?
I mean, so there are lots of things happening. So one thing that's happening is that you get a boost of so-called social neurohormones. So you have, for example, oxytocin or serotonin or endorphins that get released. And what these hormones do is, on one hand, they make you feel close to others and all warm and fuzzy. But on the other hand, they also have very direct physiological consequences for your body. So endorphins, for example, they are natural painkillers, right? Oxytocin has anti-inflammatory effects. So these hormones act on one hand on your emotions, but on the other, very directly on your body, boosting your health. Then you also have effects on your different stress systems in your body. For example, on your flight and fight response, basically the one that we evolved in the savannah. What it causes is that it calms the systems down, basically, to simplify. There are lots of, you know, glands, like adrenal glands involved, and hypothalamus in the brain, and I could, you know, name you lots of very long words here, but it just basically calms the system down and makes us release less of the hormones that have detrimental effects to our body. For example, such as cortisol or adrenaline, which if we are released on a prolonged chronic way, then they can damage our health. And when you are with other people, these systems calm down.
And is there science to quantify? Everyone likes to put a number on these things in terms of the potential extra years that we could live by adopting more of a social lifestyle, by being kinder, by being more friendly, by associating with people that maybe are like-minded and enjoying ourselves and enveloping ourselves with family. Is it possible to quantify what that could do for our longevity?
Oh, yes, there is plenty of numbers. In my book, I even have a whole chapter, you know, when you have a whole page of numbers actually put together, you know, what makes you live longer, how much. And so, for example, if you want numbers, optimism can add you from 4 to 10 years of life, right? So that's a lot. And then in terms of, for example, a happy romantic relationship, this can lower your mortality risk by about 49%. And now compare this to diet and exercise, which can each lower your mortality risk by about 20-30%. And marriage was 49. Having a very strong network of friends, neighbors, people you can rely on. So being socially integrated, that's about 45%. So also extremely, extremely high. Volunteering and charity are more or less on the same level as diet and exercise. So these are really, really big numbers we are talking in here. And of course, you know, once again, when scientists say, you know, how much diet or exercise can boost your life, they just mean, you know, eat your veggies and fruits and so on. They never say eat your kale. So definitely these things are much more important to health than we realize.
You say those are big numbers. They're staggering numbers. 49%, you said, for being in a loving relationship?
Yes, loving, committed relationship. The committed part is extremely important here. If you, for example, live with someone, a romantic partner, but you don't have this commitment till death do us part, it doesn't have to be come with an actual paper, document, whatever. But if you are committed to stay together forever, that's good enough. But if you are not, if you're like, okay, I don't know where it's going, then this doesn't have the same effect.
And let's delve into that. I wonder why. What is it about that committed partnership that helps you to live longer? Is it the reliance on another person, knowing that that person is going to be there for you, or you are going to be there for them if you have concerns about their longevity, that you're there as a partnership to work through things together?
Yes, that's exactly what it's about. You know, it's the same with friendship. So it's basically all boils down to this feeling that there is someone there for you and that they will be there for you no matter what. And for example, people often ask me as well about friendship, how many friends should I have to live longer? And the answer to that, I asked this exact question to several scientists, and the answer to that is that there is no precise number. It really depends on how you're feeling. So you can have just one very good friend and feel that all you need, but as long as you feel that this person will be there for you and will you can rely on them and that you will be there for him or her. And the same, you know, some other people may need 5 or even 7 close friends like that. It's really very personal, but you have to feel that there are people out there for you.
Some people, though, are not naturally outgoing. Some people actually prefer a much smaller group of friends and people that they associate with. Some people are, you could say, they are born loners. People seem to enjoy their own company and don't particularly like parties or bars or dinner parties or just being out with a lot of people. What are you saying about that kind of person who is naturally inclined to perhaps enjoy their own company?
There are two things here. So going to bars and crowded, parties is not required. That's for sure for your health or longevity. Unless you're an extrovert and you need it. And see, then if you are not, you cannot do it, then you maybe become unhappy and that could be detrimental. But in general, it's not necessary for health or longevity.
That's good news. But,
yes, but unfortunately, studies do show that people who are extroverted have a little bit better health than introverts. It's not a huge difference, but there is a little bit. And definitely if you're a type of a loner who really sits home by himself or, you know, by yourself, and then this is not very good because you should be connecting with your neighbors. You should be connected with your family, with your friends. As I said, bars, crowded parties, crazy, you know, rock concerts, not required. But, you know, for example, introverts, being introverted doesn't mean that you don't meet people. It means that people prefer to be one-on-one. So, for example, when they meet neighbors, they don't invite 30 neighbors at the same time for a grill. They may go have a chat one-on-one. But it's still connecting and it's still being involved. It's still being with others. But if you are a complete loner who just doesn't want to see people, that is not good for your health.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And, of course, we're having this conversation at a time when we can't do any of this or very little of this. And if we are socializing, it's in a very small group of people. There are restrictions around the world, of course, social distancing and everything that goes with dealing with COVID-19. And I'm wondering how that, perhaps with many people not realizing it, how that is harming us. And we'll continue this conversation in just a moment.
Hi, Denise Hamilton-Mace here, host of the Low No Drinker podcast, your place to go to meet the people and brands leading the low and no alcohol revolution. Every week, I speak to brand founders like Carl Anthony Brown from CrossFit Non-Alcoholic Spirits and ex-MasterChef finalist Billy Wright from Descent 10% Gin. Industry experts like Hamish Renton in our chat about how the fat jabs will impact low and no drinkers. And I help you answer questions like what the heck is the difference between non-alcoholic and alcohol-free anyways. This podcast is for you if you're looking for a fun and informative way to explore a life less intoxicated with no judgment or expectation. Check out the link in the description or find me at lownodrinkermagazine.com.
I mean, it's definitely not very good for our long-term health. As I said, you know, social isolation is very detrimental to health. You know, people who are socially isolated actually have 3 times the risk of premature death compared to people who are not socially isolated. So it's really bad. It has effects on your diabetes risk, on your cardiovascular health. Even on how you're prone to catching viruses. So which is ironic. So definitely, you know, this is not good for us, but we could all behave a little bit more like those introverts I talked about. So, but this kind of not loners, but this kind of introverts who are still social. So instead of throwing a big party, you can still see people safely one-on-one. You can still go for a walk with your friend as long as your local laws are permitting that. You can take a walk with your friend, you know, staying at a safe distance, and you can still have a nice conversation and be together, right? Definitely the fact that we are not supposed to be hugging and touching is not good for our health, because this is what causes us a great oxytocin boost. So, but you can try to get those hugs from people, for example, with whom you already live, right? If you are lucky to live with someone else, then just give them extra hugs, you know, and to get your oxytocin and social hormones boosts out of that.
And talking of viruses, that one statistic that really struck me on this subject, loners had a 45% higher risk of developing a cold than people who are more gregarious, even though they are exposed to exactly the same dose of a virus.
Yeah, it was quite a fascinating study when the researchers invited some volunteers into a lab, paid them a lot of money for that. Otherwise, I don't think anybody else would have done it. But they basically put swabs with the virus into their noses to see who will come down with the disease. And exactly people who were evaluated in psychological tests as being more more social were much less likely to become sick after that than those who are not so social. There were actually even studies done with the common coronaviruses, so not the coronavirus, the ones that were giving us colds for many centuries before already. So studies showed that when people are stressed, and definitely social isolation is a type of a stressor. So when people are stressed, they are much more likely to come down with the common coronaviruses as well. So which makes you, you know, think about how this whole situation is stressing us and how we are making ourselves potentially more prone to the very thing we're trying to avoid.
Now, you mentioned hugging a few moments ago, which is something that comes very natural to a lot of people, to hug a friend or even hug a stranger, maybe who you're introduced to, just as a form of a greeting. It wasn't until I read your book, and I live in California, that I discovered that there were cuddling centres in California, hugging centres you've explored as well, which seemed to me perhaps to be going to a little extreme. What did you find out?
I mean, I find it sad that we need those places, and they do exist. Yeah, so it's like a massage salon, but you just go for hugs. I've gone to one myself. I found it extremely bizarre, although after like the first 15 minutes it became easier. But so it's basically you go in there and you there is a instructor, or I don't know, therapist, I don't know how to call it, a person who will hug you. And you, in the one I went, I had a card where I could choose different positions, for example, of hugging positions. It's like spooning, or, you know, they had very fancy names like kitten, whatever. And then there was a couch, and you were supposed to wear comfy clothes, and you would hug. And my hugging therapist was like, you know, stroking my hair, and we're chatting a little bit. So she said that she has lots of people coming and to the center, and mostly people who just feel that in their lives they're not getting the hugs they need, either because they are generally lonely, or they just moved to the city, or for whatever reason they're not being hugged enough.
It sounds a little weird to me.
It is weird. It's very sad. And on the other hand, when I think about it, you know, if people are lonely and if they really need those hugs, then I think it is a nice way to get them. You know, it's a type of therapy. You can have a talking therapy when you just talk to your therapist, and you can have a hugging therapy. So it's sad that we need it, but I think it's good that those places exist.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously, I can't really think of any other sort of activity. Well, maybe there are a few, but very few that we really mustn't be doing at the moment. And that is getting into an enclosed space and hugging a stranger.
Yes, unfortunately, I don't think those places are allowed to function.
Yeah, exactly. One thing that you write about is sharing a meal and eating together, which I think, I mean, there are certain societies around the world, the Italians probably the best known for having a huge meal, a family gathering at the end of the day. There's an absolute, as you were saying, the UK, a three-line whip that you have to be there, you stop everything to join the family for a meal. And I think there are clearly known benefits to doing that as part of socialization. But what did you discover about the art, the science of just eating with other people?
So Professor Robin Dunbar at the University of Oxford, he's a big believer in the physiological benefits of eating together. He's been researching something called synchrony for a while now. And synchrony is basically when you do things, you know, synchronously with other people. So like marching in a band, or dancing, line dancing, or jogging in sync, or singing in a choir. And eating together is maybe not perfect synchrony, but it falls into a similar type of activity when we do things at the same time with other people. And it generally causes us a bigger release of those social hormones I mentioned before, especially endorphins, than doing things without synchrony. So for example, if you dance asynchronously with another person, then you get less of those social hormones. When if you do it in perfect synchrony, you get a bigger boost of those social hormones, which has the physiological effects on you, like, for example, as basically painkillers, and also makes you feel more included and more stronger, gives you a stronger feeling of belonging as well. So eating comes somewhere close to that as well. So when we consume a meal together with other people, so it potentially can boost our health as well because of all this endorphins and the feeling of community, of belonging, of being a group, which is extremely, extremely important for our health and longevity.
And I wonder if it's got something to do with the fact that you're socializing as you're eating, and therefore probably eating more slowly because you're talking and eating at the same time. Is it an aid to our digestion systems as well, because we're not gobbling food down quickly as you might do if you were by yourself?
I mean, we're not gobbling, that's for sure, although we tend to also eat more when we are with other people, so this is not very certain how that affects our general nutrition levels. But it's just mostly about the social part, not really digestive part, but the just feeling of inclusion that you get from dining with other people, from sharing a meal.
Now, one of the questions I often ask people on this podcast is, what motivates them, generally scientists, often leaders in their field, what motivates them to want to live a long, healthy life? Now, the answer may seem fairly obvious, that we all want to be healthy and to embrace life. There is one issue that always comes through as a reasoning for wanting to extend health span or longevity, and that is to be around for your children. It is almost always the answer, especially for those with children, that they want to be part of their children and their grandchildren's lives, to nurture them, to look after them, to share wisdom, and just be part of their existence as well as your own as they get older.
That was the first thing that came to my mind when you said that.
Exactly.
And the thing is actually that research does confirm that when grandparents are involved in the rights of their grandchildren, when they actually take care of them, but not on a everyday basis, but just kind of as usual grandparenting goes, if they are involved that way, that actually does boost their health as well. So not only it's a motivation thing, but it also has direct effects on helping us live longer.
What do you think of the way that we live our lives these days and the implications for health span and longevity? And I'm thinking of the frenetic way that we live our lives, the obsession with social media, the obsession with, I mean, especially because of COVID, we're like you and I right now, we're talking through video connection, but we're a very intense society. And I often wonder what sort of damage that is doing to our overall well-being.
I mean, certainly not good, because it chronically activates our stress axis, so makes us chronically stressed. And this has a whole cascade of hormonal and neural consequences to our bodies. And you've mentioned social media, for example, and people sometimes assume that, for example, having friends on Facebook and talking to them over Facebook or other social platforms, texting and exchanging messages this way, that this also works well. But unfortunately, studies are very clear on that it's not the same at all, nowhere close. And if you're socially isolated because, for example, you have to because of the coronavirus, or maybe, I don't know, you're disabled or something like this, and you have no other choice, then of course social media is better than nothing. But if you can meet people in person and instead of that you spend time on social media, that's absolutely detrimental. And the socializing that comes out of this kind of contact has no positive effects on our bodies.
Do you think there's going to come a tipping point when we en masse realize the detrimental impact of social media? It seems as if we're looking at a graph, the line is still going straight up. If you look at the explosion in the number of different types of social media that we can access. And personally speaking, it does become overwhelming when you have so many, because you feel as if you need to be connected, especially if you're a journalist. You feel as if you need to be accessible and respond to people and be able to talk to people. But the ways in which we can do that are multiplying exponentially, it seems. And I just wonder if there'll come a tipping point where we will realize and we'll get it and things will begin to slow down and maybe reach some sort of happy, more healthy medium.
I mean, I'm certainly hoping that this pandemic will help people realize that, first of all, we really need personal connections with other people, that we really need strong communities, that we need our friends, that relationships really matter, that exactly hugs and looking people into their eyes, real ones, not virtual ones, is extremely important for mental health and for physical health. Because we've evolved this way, we are social apes, you know, that evolved to be in a tribe. And our ancestors used to groom each other one-on-one, and this caused them release of all these hormones, endorphins, and so on. And we are still very similar. We still have very similar bodies. They still work the same way as they did on the savannah. So we need our tribes. And I hope that this pandemic will help us realize that the online is not a substitute. And I can see that, you know, when people now have to do everything over Zoom or online, they are starting to realize that they even miss, you know, gossip in the office. They thought it was something, you know, horrible, but suddenly, you know, they miss it. You know, my daughter just restarted school here in France as of Monday, is obligatory again. And all the children are happy. They're so happy to be back in school. They've never been so happy to be going to school before, you know, because they realize that seeing everybody on the screen is nowhere close to actually even the teacher. You know, they miss sitting at their desks physically and being there. So I hope that this will help us realize that we need this physical world because we are physical creatures.
There's a lot to learn from your book. I think it's hugely valuable. And reading between the lines, I think you probably learned a lot from your research as well. And I'm just curious to know if there's maybe one or two things that you discovered during the writing of this book that you're now applying to yourself that you hadn't previously given much thought to.
I mean, certainly this part about conscientiousness, you know, being the personality traits, being responsible for a big chunk of how healthy we are. So, you know, I was just upstairs and I discovered that my daughter's room again looks like a toy store exploded in there. And before it was just visual annoyance to me, but now I recognize this as actually a potential long-term health problem for her, because we know that conscientiousness is one of the biggest predictors for health, as for children as well. So it's at least as important as for me to make sure that she eats her, you know, vegetables with dinner, to make sure that she goes up there and she cleans that room, because that's teaching her conscientiousness, which is a habit basically can develop and has a great impact on health and longevity.
And there's always an area, no matter how much we know, how much we understand about the different pillars of good health, whether it be socialization, diet, or something else, there's always something that we do less well than the others, that we could do better. And I'm just curious, from your perspective, with your broad understanding, is there something that you, looking to the future, hope to do better?
I'm certainly hoping to be less neurotic, which is very bad for health. Maybe I'm not Woody Allen, but I can be sometimes worrying. I can definitely sometimes worry too much. And worrying has very detrimental effects on your, for example, your natural killer cells, and which are the cells that are responsible for getting rid of your tumors and all the pathogens. So I certainly should try to worry less. I'm working on that.
That's interesting. I think I once read that an element of worry in our lives is actually quite a good thing, because it prepares you for the fight and flight aspect of our bodies in terms of how we respond to maybe a potentially dangerous situation. So an element of worry, maybe a good thing, but I take what you're saying, that to be overwhelmed and perhaps to dwell on things too much isn't necessarily good.
Yeah, it's all about the chronic part.
Yes. Look, this has been a really fascinating conversation, Marta. Thank you very much indeed. A delight to talk to you. And I would thoroughly recommend this book. We've only really just touched the surface in terms of your research, and it really is worth delving deep into it. And there's something, to learn for everyone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I will, of course, put the details of the book into the show notes. For this episode, you'll find them at the Live Long and Master Aging website, that's llamapodcast.com, Llama being our acronym for Live Long and Master Aging. You can also follow us in social media at Llama Podcast, direct message me at Peter Bowes. The Llama Podcast is a HealthSpan Media production. If you enjoy what we do, you can rate and review us at Apple Podcasts. I do read all of the reviews. It's good to know what you think. And in fact, I'll be mentioning some of the reviews in a future episode. We have some exciting new episodes coming up. I thank you very much for listening. Take care, and we'll talk soon. FlexBeam is a portable red light therapy device that's now being used by leading athletes, including the Norwegian tennis player Casper Ruud.
Whenever you put the FlexBeam on, you feel it starts to work right away. I need something that can help repair all the fibers that I have broken in the serves.
The infrared lights penetrate your skin and makes the muscle tissue recover faster. FlexBeam, I keep it with me all the time.
Recharge Health is offering Llama Podcast listeners an $80 discount on the purchase of a FlexBeam device. Go to the website recharge.health and use the code Llama at checkout. That's LLAMA. You'll also find the link in the show notes for this episode.